welcome back to the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development podcast. I'm your host, Zach Reamer. Today's topic is a really important one, and it's on the lips of just about everyone working in child welfare, from foster parents to social workers to policymakers. And that's trauma. Now, I'm not going to define trauma just yet. I'll leave that up to my guest, who I'll introduce in a second. But serve it to say that trauma is so important to understand and recognize. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, or SAMHSA, as many as two-thirds of all children have experienced at least one traumatic event by the age of 16. And recognizing the impacts of trauma early is so important because the effects can follow a person throughout their lifetime, which could be learning problems in school and increased exposure to mental health services, the child welfare system, and the juvenile justice system. Trauma can even be a risk factor later in life for things like diabetes and heart disease. Now, to talk more about trauma, I have an expert guest joining us today. Marilyn Breuer-Zimmerman is the project director at the National Native Children's Trauma Center here at the University of Montana in Missoula. So to get started, Marilyn, would you mind telling me who you are and what your background is?
Sure. So I'm Marilyn Breuer-Zimmerman, and I'm an enrolled member of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux Tribe. And I lived in Poplar, Montana, on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation, raised my children there. My husband and I were farmers until 2002, when I returned to the University of Montana to finish my bachelor's and get my master's in social work. I returned to the University of Montana in 2007 to take the position of National Native Children's Trauma Center, and have been working with tribal communities across the nation and Alaska Native communities and American Indian communities to address childhood traumatic stress, which is something like PTSD in children who have been exposed to violence or had traumatic experiences.
And that's my next question. And, you know, it's really starting at the basics. What is trauma? Can you define it for me?
So trauma is an experience. Trauma can be brought about by an experience that threatens the life, your life, or the life of someone close to you. And it results in potentially physical injury or death, but it doesn't have to. An acute trauma might be experiencing a hurricane, a car wreck, a house fire, where chronic trauma is those that a majority of children in America experience through witnessing domestic violence, being victims of community violence or bullying, and or, did I say gangs, or exposure to gangs.
So what does it mean to have trauma? What does it look like as you live your life?
It can look like the classic PTSD symptoms. So it's a mental health, can be a mental health disorder that was first, the phrase or the symptoms were aligned to create a diagnostic disorder in Vietnam veterans. And today it can look like that in children. It's where they might have a upsetting memories about an event. They feel on edge a lot. They might have trouble sleeping. They aren't able to engage in daily living because the symptoms are interfering. They can look like they're daydreaming and when actually they're disassociating. They can be easily triggered by sights, smells, sounds, and that recall the memory of the traumatic event. And so it looks like the classic PTSD. They can flashbacks, dreaming, nightmares, that sort of thing.
So very similar to veterans. It actually affects people. Like, it's not just something that happens to you and then you move on. This kind of follows you through your life and affects your daily living.
Right, correct. So different people may experience the same event differently, however, and it's the meaning of the event that we as individuals give. So, for example, if a family of three experiences a house fire, three of those children may respond very differently to the house burning to the ground. One may feel like, you know, it was a miracle. God saved us. Isn't it wonderful that God is in our lives and was able to get us out of a house fire? Another one might be a little bit frightened, but because they might have good supports by their caregivers and their families and friends, they come back to a sense of normalcy and well-being. But the third child may ruminate on how terrifying and horrifying it could have been if they wouldn't have gotten out. And they may, those are the ones that can experience the PTSD-like symptoms or childhood traumatic stress symptoms, and they are the ones that need the extra support. So it's very much about a traumatic event occurring and an individual's response and meaning-making of that event. And we always like to ask the question, who gets to decide the meaning of the event? It's the individual. So I can't say to someone, well, you shouldn't worry about that, or you shouldn't have been afraid of that, or you shouldn't be bothered by that, because it doesn't bother me. It's really about the individual.
That's a really great example, and I think important advice to remember too. So if you don't mind, could we shift to historical trauma? What is historical trauma? How is it different from trauma that we've just been talking about? And then also, as it relates to American Indian children and families, why is it important?
Right. So historical trauma was first used by social workers and historians and psychologists, and it's a collective trauma. It's about community trauma, and it's cumulative over time. The Lakota researcher Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart is the one that coined it for American Indian communities when she began to look at Holocaust survivor research, Jewish Holocaust survivor research, and generations of families who had the grandparents or the parents may have experienced the Holocaust being in the concentration camps, but the children never had, or it was two generations away, and the children had never been in the concentration camps, yet they were exhibiting the same sorts of traumatic symptoms as their parents or grandparents. And she began to think about her own tribal community and what that could, and thought to herself, well, this seems reasonable. This seems like a reasonable explanation for the grief and the loss and the PTSD and stress and the violence in our communities. And it was a starting point for the conversation around historical trauma in tribal communities. So it can be, there's a strong belief in tribal communities that historical trauma is the outcome, the contemporary outcomes to historical trauma, where American Indian communities experienced federal Indian policy around genocide, trying to kill off Indians, then the placing them on reservations. But what may be the most detrimental is the boarding school experience, where federal policy was to remove American Indian children and Alaska Native children from their homes as young as 3 years old and send them off to harsh military-like boarding schools where they may stay for a decade at least, to be, as I think General Pratt, the first director of Carlisle Indian School, the first military boarding school for American Indian kids, said, kill the Indian, save the man. And so they experienced very harsh circumstances. There was food deprivation. There was harsh punishment. They separated sisters and brothers from one another. They played students against one another. Some of the students were treated better than others. And when they returned to their tribal communities, they returned to their communities not having been raised in their tribal parenting traditions, not having been raised in their cultural traditions. They may not want to speak their language anymore because they were punished for speaking their language. They come back not knowing how to relate to their families, what the sort of the relationship norms for interacting with other genders, like a young teenage girl may not behave properly towards an elderly uncle because she wasn't raised in her traditional ways. So she comes back not understanding the social norms of her own community. She may even believe that they are less than or that they're demonic and of the devil, some of the cultural ways. And so she comes back with those stumblings and those beliefs, and her family could definitely reject her from that. And so she's isolated. They're feeling a sense of shame. And so he has children and is unable to parent in a nurturing, culturally appropriate way. And so generations of families have been decimated just by the boarding school experience. So that's part of historical trauma. It's collective. It's part of a tribal community. It's identified by tribal communities as a result of their contact with Europeans and federal policy. but it has contemporary consequences in substance abuse, violence against one another, suicide, mental health disorders like PTSD, anxiety, and depression.
That's great history, and I'm trying to imagine myself now as a professional who's working with a child. And what do I need to know from your perspective, now that I've heard all of this, what do I do with a child who has a history of trauma or historical trauma or both? And what kind of interventions or things should I do that would work for this child?
So what the good news is that contemporary evidence-based trauma treatment models work with American Indian children and families. So we at the National Native Children's Trauma Center, our foundation is in cognitive behavioral interventions for school settings, for juvenile justice, for child welfare, for mental health. So we've got some evidence-based treatment models that we try to embed in the systems that serve American Indian children. And very often, though, the systems weren't ready to receive those evidence-based treatment models. So now we've leaned more towards implementation science and getting that system ready to sort of uptake and sustain a trauma treatment model. That's an offshoot of what you asked. So I think understanding the community context of the child, even if they're urban, there are many, in Montana in particular, there are many tribal families that will travel back and forth between an urban setting like Billings or Missoula and their reservation community. So I would, if I were providing direct service, I would think about and investigate some of the local tribal of the community of the child's family history and the reservation history. All the reservations on this, in Montana at least, they've experienced what we call the starvation winter, where there were deprivations where maybe half the population was wiped out because the agency wasn't able to bring meat to the reservation for Indians to be able to have some sustenance, and they ended up starving to death. All of them have that, at least one of those stories in their history. What is another historical event that may have occurred in that child's community that impacted the entire community that's unique to that community? The other is, did great grandma go to boarding school? What were the outcomes of that? What are the impacts of that? What are the beliefs around parenting and the relationship between parent and child? I think it just really taking the time to think about the cultural context and community context of the child.
So as a worker, you're saying it's a good idea to kind of try to investigate the history and talk to people?
I would. I mean, my guess is that anyone that's working in mental health or substance abuse in this state isn't going to have just one case from one reservation. I think it's respectful. I think it's thoughtful to be able to think in the context of the unique communities. And I think it shows a tribal community member that they're going to someone who cares about their cultural identity, not just their mental health status.
That's great advice, I think. We kind of talked a little bit about the evidence-based interventions and practices. Mm-hmm. What makes for a good intervention, and what does it mean for it to be evidence-based, and how does a worker find out if it is, and how to implement it?
So there's a National Registry of Evidence-Based Practices that you can Google, NREP, and go online. There are very few evidence-based treatment models of any kind that have been that originated around American Indian populations, but there are many that are quite successful in treating childhood traumatic stress with American Indian children. And so I always like to say to people, think about who you're working with. For instance, if it's a school, think about who the kids are. So if it's an evidence-based treatment model that was developed with Latinos in the Los Angeles Unified School District, think about the kinds of kids it was meant for. So that's what we did when we began to use the cognitive behavioral intervention for trauma in schools, or CBITS. We looked at that population and said, what do they have in common with our kids? And it was, they're exposed to high levels of violence. Ours were too. Their caregivers were impaired through substance abuse or mental health disorders. Ours were too. They were living in chronic poverty. Many of ours were too. I think I said they're exposed to violence in the home. Ours were too. And so it was just those parallels. And so we had to ask that question. First, do American Indian kids experience childhood traumatic stress? And if they do, will this evidence-based treatment model work with these kids? And the answer to both was yes. In fact, incredibly high rates of traumatic stress were being experienced by Indian children in the school district. I'll give you an example, and these are not the right numbers because it would identify the school, but in one of our schools, there was 100 students and 78 of them had high levels of PTSD-like symptoms. So we had a responsibility to treat or to respond to those kinds of high levels, and that's when we began to look at universal strategies for and to create something we call trauma-resilient school systems. And that's just training everybody from the superintendent to the bus driver to the cook to the janitor on what the kids are experiencing, the impact it has on their behaviors and on their emotions, and what small, simple, universal strategies like just kindness can do to support kids. And so I guess to be a mental health provider, I would look at, you know, the one-on-one treatment models, and then I would also look at groups, because I think groups have some evidence that they have just as much impact as one-on-one in some cases. And then I would think to myself, what will this client tolerate? So we did a survey of Billings Area Indian Health Service behavioral health providers, and we found that the population will only tolerate 3 to 4 sessions. And so if you're thinking about it in that context, you have to say to yourself, what gives me the most power with least amount of time, and what can I do? And it might be just really good crisis intervention and psychoeducation to the caregiver and to the child about what is their feeling, and give them some skills to be able to address their symptoms, to understand their triggers, to intervene when they're feeling triggered, and just, yeah, some social skills, some emotional skills, and some psychological skills and tools to be able to manage on their own.
Yeah, it sounds like being thoughtful of the situation, and not just that you can bring an individual into the room and do a therapy with them is going to fix their problems, but we're talking about a system, and you need to address everybody who these children interact with, because, you know, you're only in a room with them for 1 hour each day, maybe 4 times a week, like you said. Yeah, that's, I think, so important. And another thing that I'm interested in is, you know, maybe I don't know all the answers, and maybe this child who I'm working with, living on the reservation or not, has strengths that we can use. And so I think of this idea of resilience. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to what resilience is and why it's an important tool, especially as it relates to American Indian children.
So the simplistic answer is resilience is the ability to bounce back after an adversity or a traumatic event and come to that same place of well-being that you were before the event. And resiliency is often associated with this sort of optimistic way of being in the world, and that can be taught to adults and children. And our thoughts around resiliency are not just psychological, but really encouraging communities, tribal communities in particular, and families to connect with their culture if that's how they were raised. So to reach out to their ceremonial people and their medicine people, and engage in the ceremonies and the traditions that have brought healing to that community for 10,000 years. That builds resiliency. It builds identity. But the others are just very much around rethinking, reframing your situation, reframing the incident, reframing what you're experiencing when you have a negative interaction or a negative experience, that sort of thing. It's very much in pro-social skills building. But really, resiliency, we believe, is really based in cultural and spiritual identity.
And that's where you just said you can kind of teach that, or in most cases, it seems like reintroduce that.
That's not our role as a trauma center but we encourage. And we actually have we have on staff 2 cultural consultants. We're hoping to get a third to work in helping us adapt some of these evidence-based treatment models to be much more culturally appropriate, but also to be the connectors in the community so that when a mental health provider has a family that wants those sorts of supports, they can reach out to that person and they'll walk them through the process of being able to reach out to the medicine people in the community.
Building community, it sounds like, is one of the most important factors.
We think so.
So that's kind of my last targeted question, but what advice do you have for anyone who's working in the field that we maybe didn't already cover, or working with kids who have a past history of trauma?
Just that it doesn't take a PhD to do this work, that you can be a grandma and do good work and be supportive, that being mindful of the experiences of individuals, everyone has a story, and sometimes that story is pretty traumatic, and to make accommodations for our relatives who might be struggling and suffering with PTSD symptoms that, you know, can look like depression and anxiety too. So that's holistically. I think that the other piece that we're finding is in the systems that are serving American Indian, Alaska Native children is that the professionals, whether they're teachers or child welfare workers, are often tribal members. They may not be from that particular tribe, but they are often tribal members, and they have long trauma histories of their own that go unrecognized or unacknowledged. And that a big piece of the work of working with kids with trauma histories in Indian country is to look at your own history, understand your own history and your own trauma, and address it. Get the supports you need so that you aren't triggered by their behaviors and you aren't engaging behaviors that trigger them.
That was great advice that Marilyn left us with. You might still be wondering what more you can do, and my advice is just to educate yourself as much as possible. Learn what trauma looks like and what the effective practices for working with kids who have trauma are. Generally, preschool-aged children affected by trauma might show anxiety when separated from parents, while kids in elementary school might have trouble staying concentrated or have feelings of shame or guilt. This can progress to risky behavior with sex or drugs in high school, or feelings of depression, or engaging in self-harm activities. Now, these things don't always mean that trauma is lurking under the surface, but if it is, it's so important to address so you can adopt a trauma-informed care. For Native youth, all of this is doubly true because of historical trauma potentially being a factor. There's a lot to learn about trauma and traumatic stress and historical trauma, and there's a lot of great resources out there too. One of them is actually the Center. In fact, the Center has a large portion of the website dedicated to trainings. We have one on trauma under the Foster Parents tab that you could go and take right now if you wanted to. We also have a schedule up for our in-person trainings, so be sure to check that out. Just go to health.umt.edu/CCFWD and click on the Trainings tab. Of course, the National Native Children's Trauma Center is a great resource, and they offer trainings too. You can go to their website and read more about their work at www.nnctc.org. But the best way to get in touch about the trainings they offer is to call their office, 406-243-2716. That's 406-243-2716. And one more is SAMHSA, which I mentioned earlier and got a lot of my information from. Just go to SAHMSA.gov for a ton of national resources. Thank you so much to Marilyn for spending some time with me and talking about such an important subject. Thanks to Ira Wolf for our music, and thanks to you for listening. I hope this conversation was helpful if you have been thinking about incorporating a trauma-informed approach into your work. I also hope you'll join me for future episodes where we'll have more great guests to discuss other important topics in child protection and welfare. Please let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear by contacting us via email at ccfwd@mso.gov. www.umt.edu. This has been the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development podcast with me, your host, Zach Reamer. Until next time, take care of yourself, and I'll see you then.